This Tridio production is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and made possible by you, our listener. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit tridio.com/donate.
You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 25.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years. I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush. Hi, I'm Don Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss the latest episodes of the hit series Doctor Who. Today we're discussing the third episode of Season 10, Thin Ice. Joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Stika from Malta, Montana. Hi, Father Corey.
Howdy, how's it going?
It's great. And Jimmy Akin from San Diego. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, glad to be here.
So let's get right into some news, some interesting news. We all know this is the last season for Peter Capaldi's Doctor, Doctor 12. And so we're waiting to hear from the producers, from the BBC, from whomever, who the new Doctor is going to be, what actor is going to be playing that role. There's been lots of speculation. I've heard all kinds of crazy names. I've heard Idris Elba, who I kind of think would be great, although I like him as James Bond, frankly. I think Idris Elba is a great actor. And all these other names, including lots of British actors I've never heard of. Some people even wanted to have a woman take over the role and all these other variations. But Jimmy, there's been some talk and rumors and one that seems to have risen to the top that you brought to my attention. What is it that you've heard?
Well, apparently, in the British newspapers right now, there's a widespread story going around. It apparently started in the Daily Star, which I guess is a tabloid over there. Mm-hmm. They claim to have an insider on the show who says that an actor – and so if you don't want to be spoiled about a rumor –
Yeah, skip ahead maybe three or four minutes. Yeah,
but that there's a British actor named Chris Marshall, Chris with a K, who has been cast as the next Doctor. And they're reporting that he's even begun filming, which wouldn't be unreasonable given that the new Doctor is slated to appear no later than the Christmas special, and that's only 7 months away. So you would think that the BBC would have either cast someone by now or be very close to casting someone. When contacted, the BBC said, "We have made no casting decisions regarding season 11, which is the next season after the Christmas special." And that could be, people have pointed out, a carefully worded statement that they have said they haven't cast a new Doctor for the Christmas special. They just haven't confirmed any casting for the next season.
Right.
So, you know, it's a little unclear what to make of this. There's been a bunch of reaction to this. The actor, Chris Marshall, has a background in playing comedy. He starred or featured in a sitcom called My Family. He also appeared in the movie Love Actually, if I recall, and mm-hmm. yeah. He, for a few years, has been a prominent character in a kind of crime comedy called Death in Paradise, which is set in the Caribbean.
Yeah, the one that probably most of our American listeners would recognize is the Love Actually one. I haven't seen any of these others. I've been looking at his IMDb listing, and nothing really stands out as something I've seen.
Right. Well, there was also Death at a Funeral, which was a series. I think it was like an HBO series or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One thing that's kind of interesting about this rumor is that Peter Capaldi said to the Graham Norton show, of course, you know, his talk show on BBC, BBC America, that he's already filmed the regeneration scene.
Right.
And so, of course, now the rumors are flying that it might not actually be the Christmas special, but it might actually be during season 10. Which
right.
I'm taking from the past, of course.
And given that doctors have had lengthy regenerations before, particularly Doctor Number 10, David Tennant, mm-hmm. He had, even after he was dosed with the radiation that brought on his regeneration, he visited a whole bunch of people, and actually the entire 50th anniversary special occurs during the course of his regeneration in his timeline. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible that Peter Capaldi's regeneration could be a rather lengthy affair that could span both the last episode of the season and the Christmas special.
Correct.
Of course, is there anything to prevent them have already filmed the Christmas special too? I mean, is it just because we think that they haven't filmed the Christmas special that we think it could happen during the regular season?
As of recently, I saw some interviews with Peter Capaldi and Stephen Moffat where they were just about to film the Christmas special. So they may have done it by now, but I haven't seen anything saying that it's been done for a fact.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's possible, too, it'll be like Christopher Eccleston's regeneration, which happened at the end of the first season.
Yes.
Literally right at the very end. And then the Christmas special was the first full with David Tennant.
Right.
Right.
Now, there's been some people who have been unhappy with this casting news because they don't like Chris Marshall as an actor, although some have said they thought he's boring. Other people have said, no, he's a great actor. But that's going to happen with any actor. But some people have been unhappy because he happens to be white and male, which is the pattern with the previous Doctors, and there's been a growing desire on the part of many fans to see someone different in the role.
Right.
The idea of a woman Doctor was first floated actually by Tom Baker when he left, and that kind of kicked that off. He wished good luck to the next Doctor, whoever he or she may be, and that mm-hmm. kind of started the Doctor as a woman thing. There's also been a desire to see people who aren't white, like Idris Elba. Yep. One name that's been floated of a black actor who I think would actually make a really good Doctor is a British comedian named Richard Ayoade, who has this really nice comedic, geeky aspect to his personality and the different roles he's played. And those two elements, the comedy and the geekiness, would fit really nicely and make they really set one up for being a good Doctor.
And he is very much well known and beloved by kind of the geek culture because he was an IT Crowd.
Exactly, yes.
Oh,
which
okay.
is an incredibly funny, geeky show.
There have also been a bunch of names of women actresses who've been suggested. I'm not so familiar with them personally. One is from, I believe, Game of Thrones, and I don't watch that. Also, Rising Damp, an actress from that, has been suggested, I think. I haven't seen that really. But I think likely one day we're likely to get a female Doctor. I kind of don't think it's going to happen this time. Because a female Doctor, and I've written about this before, a female Doctor would change the dynamic of the show very significantly. You think about the relationships with the companions and so forth. And if you either continue with predominantly female companions, or if you switch over and have predominantly male companions, either way, you have a different feeling to the show. My sense of the appropriate time to bring in a female Doctor would be one of two times. Either when the show is about to be canceled and you need to boost the ratings and try to bring in a new audience, or when it has been canceled and you're reviving it and you want to make a big splash and attract a bunch of new viewers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the appropriate time, or one of those would be the appropriate time, to have a female Doctor for the first time. Once we have the first female Doctor, it'll become a much more normal, usual thing.
Given the fact that we have the Master as Missy already, the Master becoming a female Time Lord, and Missy being so very popular, I think that lowers the bar or the obstacle to a female Doctor. I have heard that the BBC this time put down its foot and said, we're not going to consider a female Doctor this time, maybe for the reasons that you gave, Jimmy. Although I have to say that the other time that I can imagine them deciding to go with a female Doctor is when you're having this wholesale change in the person running the show, the companion, because we've heard that Bill is a one-season companion, and the Doctor. You know, that I could see that being a time when they would decide to change it. And given that there has been talk that the ratings of the past few years, which unfortunately because of it coincides with the time of Peter Capaldi, haven't been as high as they've been before. So it is it's unfortunate. I don't know that it's. I'll just say I really like Peter Capaldi. I think he's been a great doctor, but it has coincided with his tenure. I could see them saying, "Well, we need to kind of shake things up and bring in someone." That said, I kind of agree that I don't think that they're doing it this time, given a few things, but also because of the Chris Marshall rumor being so strong, and having heard that the BBC has decided against having a female doctor this time out. So
yeah, I think what they're trying to do this time is find somebody like David Tennant who'll boost the ratings again.
Right.
Because he was a younger, attractive, comedic doctor, and I think they're trying to get back that vibe. And if that doesn't work, then they might go a more radical route.
Right. Okay. All right, so I think we went well beyond our 2 or 3 minutes, so I apologize to anyone who fast-forwarded and got spoiled. I don't think we mentioned the actor's name too often. So let's when there's news, we'll talk about it in another episode. But let's talk about this episode. Thin Ice. Just a brief, one sentence off the top. What was your overall, did you like it or did you not like it? And then, I don't want to get too much detail, I just want to kind of get your sense of, did you like this one or did you, or was it not a great one for you? And then we'll get into the details. So Jimmy, why don't you start?
I liked it.
Okay.
It wasn't great, but I liked it.
Okay. Brother Corey?
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. It was an enjoyable episode, but yeah.
Okay, so my first impression was, I wasn't really excited about it. The first time I watched it, I liked it better the second time I watched it. I always watch every episode at least twice before we do the show. Once to just kind of go through it, quickly, and the second time to get details so we can have something to talk about. All right. So that said, so you kind of know our impressions coming in. A little bit about the background of the episode. The writer of the episode is Sarah Dollard. One of the few female writers that they have that they go to. This is actually her second episode. She wrote Face the Raven, which I thought was a great episode.
Generally well liked by fans. Yeah,
to write a death scene for a companion, death in quotes, for her companion is a significant task for a first-time writer on Doctor Who, and I think she handled it very well. In fact, I kind of wish she had written the episode before that as well, which wasn't as great. And then she kind of jumps in here to this very interesting premise, which is, as we talked about last time, a frost fair. The doctor and Bill step out from the TARDIS. They're expecting to be back in the doctor's office. And as the doctor has just said recently in the previous episode, that the TARDIS takes you where it thinks you need to go, as opposed to, you negotiate with it. So the TARDIS thinks they need to go to this time and place to a frost fair. And the doctor explains. But basically, a frost fair is the Thames, which is the river that runs through the middle of London, regularly froze over between, I think, the 14th and 19th century. And the last time it happened was February 4th, 1814, which is the date that they are... Well, February 1814, and the frost ended, the ice broke up on February 4th, and that's the date that the Doctor and Bill have showed up here. And the frost fairs were basically the fishermen who usually would work the Thames, unable to make a living because it's frozen, would hold fares on the ice and charge admission. Okay, it's interesting the Doctor mentions that he's been to the Frost Fair before, which we never actually see it in an episode, but it's mentioned several times. Jimmy, do you have those mentions, Andy?
Yeah, we don't see it in an episode, but there have actually been like 4 different times the Doctor visited this specific Frost Fair, the one in 1814. And it's been several different Doctors. They've appeared in different forms of media, like in some of the, some of the written stories, some of the audio stories, you get references to them. The one reference from a TV show is River Song, said at one point that the 11th Doctor had taken her to the last of the Great Frost Fairs, and he'd had Stevie Wonder play Happy Birthday to her under London Bridge. And there have been fans who have noted on the – because the TARDIS gives us a diagram of the Thames and where the creature is, and it looks like they're meaning the bridge in this episode to be London Bridge. And so this Frost Fair only lasted for like 4 days, and so the 12th Doctor has narrowly missed his 11th self at this exact spot within like 2 or 3 days.
Yes. But I have the list actually if you want. It's the second the second Doctor visited in a novel, a 1997 novel, The Roundheads, written by Mark Gatiss, a longtime Doctor Who writer. The 10th Doctor visited this Frost Fair in an online short story called The Frozen. So I might actually go try to find that somewhere. The first Doctor visited in a Big Finish audio play called Frostfire. The Doctor offered Clara a visit in the Caretaker episode in 2014, in which which would have made good on a promise he made in the novel The Silhouette, which is interesting. So they didn't actually visit, but he offered a visit. And then that River Song in the 2011 episode of Good Man Goes to War. So it's interesting how they keep coming back to these Frost Fairs throughout Doctor Who. It must have a sort of, I'm trying to think of the term, a connection in the British psyche about this, these Frost Fairs. There must be a nostalgic connection here in for people in pop culture.
Yeah, and it's just really cool. I mean, I guess this was – I don't know if technically this was the end of the Little Ice Age, but it's something that doesn't happen anymore in England. Right. You know, there was this period a few hundred years ago during – I guess it was the Maunder Minimum with the sun, where it got a lot colder here on Earth, and this would happen. And so it's kind of an exotic thing to think of the Thames freezing up so much that you could have elephants walking on it. And, you know, if that happened in my hometown, that would be really cool, even if it was only historically. But if you do a count of the Doctors that are connected with this Frost Fair, it's the 1st, the 10th, the 11th, and the 12th.
And so the 2nd.
And the 2nd. So you've got five different Doctors who have apparently visited or talked about visiting this Frost Fair.
Right. The whole thing about the Thames freezing, I think maybe we'll jump into this, a little bit of the controversy here, although we can revisit it, which is that this episode touches on a handful of, 21st century, controversial issues. I'm trying to find my note on it, 'cause I think I placed it somewhere else in my notes at a later point in the show, and I can't find it. But
I think that the obvious one is, of course, climate change,
right?
That because 1814 was really kind of the dawn, sort of the Industrial Revolution, or like right just before it, so we hadn't been putting quite the pollutants into the environment that we did by the end of the 19th century, things like that.
So climate change. So the last of the Frost Fairs, and now it doesn't get cold enough anymore, and that's because of industrialization. It's the contemporary understanding. Racial issues and slavery, animal rights. Sort of. That's sort of an issue that kind of gets addressed.
With the creature. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, and sexism too.
Sexism.
That's in here because it's in the solution to the episode.
Okay, we'll come back.
They address the question to that.
Okay. Oh, right. The inheritance, and also redistribution of wealth from the wealthy to the poor. That's another issue. They kind of cram a whole lot in here. The thing that gets me with the climate change one is in fact, the reason that it doesn't freeze anymore is that the creature that was imprisoned is the thing that caused the freezing. It was a creature causing the cold. What's that?
It kind of subverts that issue.
Exactly.
Because it's not the Industrial Revolution that makes it hot. It's the creature that makes it cold.
Yes.
Exactly.
So I've just kind of found it interesting that so many watching this that were kind of reviewing it were focusing on the climate change issue when in fact the show itself undermines that. So I just thought that was interesting. So let's kind of jump in. The show moves through the plot fairly quickly, I felt like. So we're not going to have to spend a ton of time on anything individual. We start with they step out of the TARDIS right from where they left off in the last episode. The elephant standing in front of them, and then we get right into this question of Bill's ethnicity. Point when he steps out and he wants to go explore, she's like, "Well, there's a big problem. I'm black. Melanin." She points at herself. Skin pigment that shows how dark our skin is. This season of Doctor Who seems to want to make a bigger deal of Bill's ethnicity than they did most of the time with Martha Jones, who was also darkly complected, right. I think African American heritage, I think, is, or African British. I fell into that. fell into that trap. African heritage, put it that way, as opposed to Indian. I don't think the actress who played, I didn't look it up, but the actress who played was, but it's sort of irrelevant. But the fact is they didn't make a big deal of it, except as in with Martha Jones, except for one episode, which was Family of Blood, where the Doctor who forgets who he is, and Martha ends up being a servant in a time period right before World War One. So, what do you think of this?
There's also another episode in the Shakespeare Code when they visit 1599. Martha also voiced a concern about her color and slavery. So that has come up on the show before, but they haven't made a big deal of it.
Okay.
By the way, I looked up the actor. Martha Jones, actress, is actually half Iranian, half Ghanaian.
Oh wow! Oh. That's an. I mean, that's interesting.
Both African and Middle Eastern.
Right. Yeah. Right. So I looked. I did a little historical research into British history too, and so the slave trade had been banned by Britain in 1807. The Frost Fair is 1814, but slavery itself had not been completely abolished until 1833. So
that's in the Empire though. It had already been banned in England itself. There was a case in the late 1700s where a judge declared it illegal in England itself, and then it took time for that to ripple out through the rest of the British Empire.
Although, as in my reading of it, it was – I don't want to get too much into the details. Yeah. That it took time for – it wasn't a definitive all slavery ends. It took time for – that to sort of ripple out even into all of Great Britain, where all slaves had been freed. Nevertheless, the people in black people in London or Britain in 1814 would still have been a second class. That's entirely entirely certain. So Bill's concern is, that she will be stand out. That she'll be discriminated against. I'm not exactly sure what she was afraid would happen to her in this time period.
Based on the line reading, they leave it ambiguous, but based on the way the line is written, she just says slavery is still a thing. And you could infer from that she thinks she might be enslaved, which she wouldn't at this period, but she might not know that as a 21st century person. She may be fuzzy on the exact history of how this all happened, because it happened in stages.
To be fair, too, just because something was made illegal doesn't mean it immediately went away.
True. Right. What I like about this is the way they handled this between her and the Doctor, and the subject will come up later in the show, too, but at this particular moment, I liked it later too, but at this moment I like the way they handled it, because she points out to him, melanin, slavery is still a thing, and he just says, yeah. And that kind of is illustrative of the Doctor's approach to traveling in time. There are things he's going to encounter that are bad and that he can't do anything about. I mean, he can save people's lives at times, he can even change entire cultures at times, but he can't just walk in and fix everything in every culture. And that's just part of the price you pay if you're going to time travel, is you can't fix everything. And he has to acknowledge that. And this is kind of his – it brings an interesting element to Bill's awakening as a new time traveler of, there are these things that we're going to encounter and they're bad. And we can recognize mm-hmm. that, but we can – that if we're going to time travel, we have to be prepared to deal with those things.
I enjoy this aspect of Bill finding things out, you know, sort of getting used to the various elements of traveling with a doctor that someone has to – and I like also the fact that they have her voicing these concerns about logical inconsistencies that fans have been harping on for years, and
the
rules of time travel.
I love how they just kind of immediately just slap the whole butterfly effect. You know, you step on a butterfly, now Pete's gone. You don't even remember him. Ooh, who's Pete?
There was a great little dialogue back and forth, and you know, how do you think Pete feels about that? And then at the end, he kind of just says. He says, "Who's Pete?" At the end, but he also sort of just waves away her concerns after addressing it a little bit. He just says, "You know," he basically says, "You know, yes, you affect time just by living your life because you affect the things that are going to happen, you know, in the future from your present." So, and he basically says, "It's just time travel. Don't overthink it."
Yeah, that's a non-answer answer.
Yeah.
Affecting my future is not the same thing as rewriting my history.
Exactly.
And I don't want to come back and live in a world dominated by Nazis or something like that.
Of course, from the doctor's viewpoint, I mean, it's still, I mean, you know, going back to the first episode of this season, he sees all of, you know, from his point of view, time is the future is the same as the present, the same as the past, and so... You know, affecting the present, quote unquote, is for him no different. It affects the future that he already knows, just like affecting the past would affect the present. So I can see from his point of view, but I think in essence, what we're getting here is typical Stephen Moffat, which is, look, stop worrying about the details and just enjoy the story.
This isn't the paradox you're looking for.
There's a technical term in script writing for this kind of maneuver. It's called hanging a lantern.
Yeah.
The idea is if there's a problem in the story that you know the audience is going to be thinking about, you can sort of diffuse it by pointing it out and then moving on. And that's called hanging a lantern on the problem.
Right.
And they do this a bunch in Doctor Who.
So we'll hang a lantern on this problem too, and we'll move on to to them going onto the ice, and then we have this ominous view of the feet seen and voices heard from under the ice. This classic visual technique of seeing something from the viewpoint of the creature or the villain or the monster or whatever it is in whatever story we're seeing. So we see this very interesting viewpoint. Bill wants to try all the food until she sees how unappetizing most of it is to a 21st century person.
Yeah.
And the doctor loves it. He's got his favorite little piece of offal that he's got there on a stick. And
we probably shouldn't discuss what that likely is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we don't want to know. And then they really – so the cast, the background characters, and I don't know whether it's intentional or not, have been cast in this sort of anachronistic racial makeup where you have quite a lot of people who are black or Asian, of Indian background, varying in a composite makeup that history tells us would not have been common at that time period. But they address it sort of as so Bill says Regency England is more black than they show in the movies, and the doctor responds, "So was Jesus. History's a whitewash." What do you think of this sort of was history whitewashed? Was it are the movies a little too white?
In terms of the movies, and we can extend that to TV as well, I don't know that – I think it depends on when the movie's made. Now, first of all, just to address the Jesus question, so he was of Middle Eastern background. He was probably darker complected than he's been portrayed in some movies.
Yep.
Yeah, fine, no big deal. he probably didn't have sub-Saharan characteristics, but it's not a matter of faith anyway. So we don't particularly need to worry about that. In terms of the depiction of racial mixtures in movies, I think it very much depends on when you're talking about. If you're talking about older movies and TV shows, say made in Hollywood or made in London, you did tend to have lots of white people cast in these roles, and they didn't place an emphasis on getting people of other race into the scenes.
And in fact,
they often had white people dressed up
right.
as people of other races.
Yes.
So I think the whitewash charge is fair for older movies. Today we have something of the reverse, where there's because we're living in a racially integrated society today, there's a desire to show racial integration in the past in a way that may have been more than it actually was. And so in movies and TV today, you tend to see more racial mixing than may have actually happened. But if you think about this time period, well, okay, Britain has its empire at this point, and there are going to be some people, and they're going to be particularly in London, because that's the major, you know, city in England where you're going to have – it's the capital of the empire, and empire capitals always have lots of people from the provinces coming in. If this were set somewhere else in England, like in the north or in the west, it would have probably have less racial mixing. But here in London, it makes sense.
Okay, so all right, that makes a lot of sense to me. Given the makeup of it, we often want our entertainment and even our art, and this goes back well before movies and TV, to sort of reflect us and who we are in that sense. And in fact, to go back to Jesus, cultures in all over the world have often created art that depicts Jesus as someone from that culture, whether Japan or Africa or that sort of thing. Okay. So we have the lights under the ice that Bill notices.
Another one of her great questions, are there physical effects to time travel?
Right.
Yeah.
Which we know there are, actually, that, given the with River and Amy and things like that, we do know that there are physical effects. But they're interrupted by a street urchin, or river urchin in this case, stealing the doctor's sonic screwdriver. Then they have the usual conversation of why it's called a sonic screwdriver.
Makes noise.
It makes noise, and it's sort of like a screwdriver. The standard unsatisfying explanations for why it's called a sonic screwdriver.
More great Bill questions, though.
Yes. Yes. She's very insightful. She always asks the good questions. Sometimes their other companions have not asked questions as I've yelled at them. Ask him about such and such. They chase the boy out toward the thin ice, and the girl, Kitty, and the boy's name Spider. And the lights circle around under him and create a hole that the boy falls through, except for it closes up around his arm, and the screwdriver is held up. Now, I got to say, this isn't the first person who's gone under. I kind of skipped that. There was a man who had been drunk. Who'd fallen through and got eaten by the creature under the ice. And so now we have this, the boy. And I got to tell you, I was a little disturbed by the doctor's reaction. And I guess a lot of fans were at first. The doctor did not seemed more concerned about this getting a screwdriver back than about the boy being killed. He seemed very callous and cold, which Bill is extremely disturbed. She's never, like most people who are watching this show, has never actually seen someone killed in front of them in real life.
Right.
You may have
seen a relative or a loved one die in a hospital.
Right.
But
right.
Seeing someone eaten by an animal in front of you, most of us have not experienced that.
Right. And maybe the audience has become sort of inured to seeing death on Doctor Who, for example, but other TV shows as well. And Bill kind of reminds us that it's not okay. What did you think of the first? Let's talk about, what did you think of the Doctor's first reaction to the boy? Were you disturbed by that? I was kind of disturbed by that. Father Corey. When he gets his screwdriver back, the boy sucked under. He seemed more concerned about the screwdriver than about the boy.
And that was kind of my reaction too, of like, you know, but again, this is kind of playing into the Peter Capaldi Doctor, you know, kind of getting, you know, as he was the first season, especially where he was almost unconcerned about anything outside of himself, at least as far as how he comes across emotionally.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, like, I mean, that was kind of the running gag in the first season of, you know, Clara having to be his handler to help him respond appropriately with the flip cards and everything, right. You know.
She's my carer. She cares. Yeah. Which is interesting, given what we've heard, that this season the Doctor was going to be a little more soft and cuddly. And maybe by the end of this episode he kind of returns to that. But this is maybe a bit of a reminder of how the Doctor can be.
And I think his response to Bill about why he responded as he did makes it clear why.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that was a good response. You know,
they have a back and forth, a dialogue, in fact, where she's trying to get him to, you know, tell me how many people you've seen die. Well, he's seen billions die, right? How many?
He doesn't say.
He doesn't answer her. And when she asks him straight up, have you ever killed anyone? He offers these sort of non-answers, but she pursues him until he says yes. But then he explains himself a bit, you know, that he has to move on, or he'll be ineffective. More people will die.
In terms of the boy's death, now this is very unusual for Doctor Who. We normally have people dying in Doctor Who, but normally it's not children.
Right.
And so that is a deliberate ramping up of the emotional stakes. And the Doctor does come across as much colder than you'd think. Even the distraction of the sonic screwdriver, which also Bill totally nails by describing it as his magic wand, because that's its function in the story. It's a magic wand. But even his concern about that is something that the actual Doctor really probably wouldn't feel that much, because he's got a whole thing of sonic screwdrivers sitting on his desk. Yeah. He can make them at will. He can have the TARDIS pop them out. And so it's not like he's going to be harmed substantially by losing a sonic screwdriver. Also, this is 1814. Nobody's going to be able to duplicate it, so he's not infecting a culture with technology.
Mm-hmm.
He does have a particularly kind of cold reaction, but the function of that in the story seems to be entirely this sort of educating Rita theme that they're working in this series, where he's introducing Bill to the realities of time travel. And those include seeing people die, even in shocking circumstances like this child, and being unable to help them. But you have to move on, or more people are going to die.
And, you know, the fact is, too, there are people that their emotional response to seeing something like this is not grief. It's not, at least not initially, but it's almost a hyper focus on what they need to do.
Exactly. How do I solve this? What do I do next?
You know, and then when they can stop and think about it, then the grief will come.
Yeah.
And perhaps an element of a reminder that the Doctor, remember, is not human and doesn't react to things, and he's not safe. You know, the Doctor is somewhat dangerous. He's in.
He's not a tamed lion.
He's not. I was going to go to that very same analogy that Aslan gives, that he is not a tamed lion. So there's aspects of that, I think, in there. So we get to see where the street urchins are living it rough. I love these Britishisms. I'm going to start incorporating them into my everyday conversation. they're living it rough. This little diverse little group of children, including the very cute little moppish blonde girl. And they go to their home. The Doctor reads a bedtime story. Bill kind of gets over her anger at the doctor and her shock at the death of this child. And they find out that there's someone has been, you know, paying the children to get people onto the ice to the Frost Fair. The doctor decides to kind of see what's down there under the ice and get some great Jules Verne diving suits for them. They get.
By the way, could we go back to the children's story that he
sure.
reads for just a second? So he's reading this story about a little boy who sucks his thumb and the horrible things that will happen to you if you're a little boy who sucks your thumb. And this kind of story was told widely by these kind of cautionary tales for children. Were told to children in for centuries, like Hansel and Gretel is an
right.
example of that. It's basically don't trust strangers, don't go into their houses. And there were a lot of things like to correct bad habits of children. There would be stories like thumb sucking that would be made up about them. And in fact, this is a real story. It's anachronistic. The doctor is apparently reading a book that was published 31 years after this story was set. So he's reading a book from the future, which, of course, he could do. But this is a tale of Conrad, a young boy nicknamed Little Suck-a-Thumb. And the end of the story, the mother in the story is warning Little Suck-a-Thumb that a great tailor, because tailors have scissors, will come and snip off his thumbs if he doesn't stop sucking them. And that's exactly what happens in the end of the story.
Oh, goodness. The gruesome Victorian literature. I love it for children.
Oh, yeah.
You know, actually, before I get back to the diving suits, at one point, Bill asks the doctor, can you do magic? And then he kind of gets this look in his face, and she says, oh, excuse me, is that a rude question? Because, in fact, the doctor performs magic tricks throughout this episode, like pulling pies out of his hat, and yep. he's obsessed with the coin trick of the pie vendor. And as you said, Jimmy, the doctor's sonic screwdriver is a magic wand. And in fact, so the doctor is sort of a magical being at times, as we've said so many times. This is not so much science fiction as it is science fantasy in many ways.
Right.
So the doctor is somewhat magical.
They even have prior episodes where magic seems to be real. The John Pertwee serial Doctor Who and the Demons apparently treats magic as real. Normally, though, they Scooby-Doo it and provide some kind of science fiction explanation for otherwise magical effects.
And in fact,
was it Terry Pratchett that said that about how any advanced technology will appear magical to a lesser civilization? Paraphrasing
Arthur Clarke.
Arthur
okay. C. Clarke. Yeah.
I knew it was an author, but I couldn't remember which.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, or something to that effect. But
yep.
but in fact, the doctor mentions magic, as I recall, when they're watching the wrestling match. You know, it's not really wrestling unless it's in zero G with tentacles and magic
yeah.
spells. So
<Yep.
laughs> so he brings it up himself. So they're under the ice. Long story short, they encounter this giant creature held by chains, and they find the evidence that the creature has been eating multiple people, not just this little boy. They come up from under the ice through a hole cut in it by the pie salesman, who was apparently serving these very strange creatures in his pie that he's been catching. And then
Bill said she liked.
Yes, she,
yeah.
I like that pie.
And there's the great bit about the tattoo here.
Yes, so the children had identified the man paying them to bring people to the fair as having a ship tattoo on his hand, and so the doctor quizzes the pie man. Have you seen someone around here with a ship tattoo?
And he gets this look like. That the doctor misinterprets is like, oh, are you against tattoos? I'm against tattoos too. I think we're bonding.
Yeah.
but of course the guy's like, we're down by the docks. Of course I've seen people with a guy with a ship tattoo.
There's all these sailors around.
Yeah,
exactly.
So Bill gets to the heart of it and says, have you seen anything unusual? And they tells them that the dredgers are acting suspiciously, and they're down the river at this other place. And so the dredgers, by which we mean river dredgers, people who, to keep the river from silting up and becoming impassable for ships, a dredger would you know, be constantly digging up silt and dirt and other, you know, whatever at the bottom of the river to keep a channel clear. So the dredgers are at this facility a mile away down the river. And so the doctor and Bill head down there to where the dredgers are working. He uses psychic paper several times in this episode, which we haven't seen in a while, a few episodes, and gets admitted into this secret operation and encounters the overseer, where it's this great back and forth where he basically gets the overseer to reveal everything, the entire plan, with some clever misdirection and dialogue, and, you know, tells him, look, we've got to speak in code because somebody could come in here and get you to blab everything otherwise, which is what he does.
Exactly what he's doing.
They figure out that the they're dredging up basically the creature's waste, the creature's excrement, and turning it into a super fuel, a coal, a super coal. It burns 1,000 times harder than coal, or it can even burn underwater. To which we have the very clever sound editing, where the overseer says it burns even underwater, and she says no, and then you have a cut to another scene with a horse neighs we have no bleep.
No bleep. Yeah. Also, there's an interesting kind of explanation in there in that same scene where he says, and the explanation is because of the fuel they won't let us smoke in here. And this is another kind of retcon, because this is 1814 in Britain. It's a fair. People are out having fun. There are going to be people smoking here.
Yes.
A lot of people, most likely.
A lot of people. And we don't see any of that because of how skittish British television is about that right now. And so they give us a kind of on-screen explanation that at least applies to where the dredgers are.
Okay. And it turns out that they're delivering the super fuel to the steel mills. Again, beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and so we have this fuel going to steel mills. And it's all being run by Lord Sutcliffe. So the doctor decides to go confront Lord Sutcliffe. Lord Sutcliffe... So the doctor thinks at first he might be an alien because this fuel would be good for a rocket. Yeah, I think Lord Sutcliffe is a bit of an anticlimactic villain. I don't think he pays off for the build up. There just isn't much there with him. He's sort of cartoonish a little bit. You know, all he needs is the mustache to twirl. You know.
And he doesn't exactly get a lot of screen time. He says three or four lines and gets decked out by the doctor. Right, comes back, says a couple more lines, then tries to blow stuff up. And that's basically his character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a lot of development.
He's very one-dimensional, even for a Doctor Who villain. Part of the reason for that is because I would suspect is because of his function in the story involves racism. And so, you know, we have this interesting sequence where the doctor and Bill have showed up at his house. They're in his sitting room waiting for him to be brought in. Mm-hmm. The doctor tells Bill, I need you to be quiet and let me do the talking because you're, you know, going to be emotional and say something you shouldn't. And of course, you know, they're setting us up for the doctor is going to do that.
Right. Yep, exactly.
And so then Lord Sutcliffe comes in. Bill has sat down on a chair. And it's a sitting room after all, you know, you'd expect that. Lord Sutcliffe comes in and he has this over the top reaction to her sitting, telling her to stand in the presence of her betters. And the doctor becomes enraged and decks him. And it's a really satisfying moment. And they conclude, therefore, he's a human. This racism is too genuine to be an act put on by an alien.
Right. Well, and he specifically calls her an animal.
I forgot that part.
He walked in, something like, who let this animal in here or something along that context. Maybe it wasn't the word animal, but it was that was very clearly the context that he was using.
I think it's creature. I think he says
creature.
Yeah.
Yeah, creature. Well, I mean, in the 19th century, creature didn't necessarily have animal connotation. I mean, it's right there, like in the King James version of Mark, preach the gospel to every creature under heaven, just means anyone God has created.
Right. True.
But it had a negative connotation, though.
It wasn't exactly animal.
It had a less than human. It had a less than human connotation.
Right.
At least the way I heard it and I understood it.
Okay. Yeah.
Which would have fit the context of the character. You know, he's the racist boar.
Well,
so.
he's meant to be the racist boar. I actually had a question though of whether if they want to portray him that way, if they did it sufficiently explicitly in the script, because Britain at this time was not only like other places in the world having a problem with racism, it also had a big problem with classism. And if he had come in and found a white male Cockney sitting in his chair in his sitting room, he easily could have just as well demanded he get up in the presence of his betters.
Right.
And so if, I know that the doctor and Bill took this as racism on his part, and the audience is meant to. But if you think about the history of these things, I think they may have needed to go a little farther in the script to establish that his objection was not just that he's her better, but that specifically that she's not white.
Right.
And it's the first moment, actually, in this whole episode, the only moment in which race really plays a role, despite Bill's fears at the beginning. You know, in fact, Regency England seems to be very, very not racist for the most part, as depicted in this episode. So it's kind of interesting, sort of in some ways, like with the climate change aspect, sort of undermines itself in how severe the problems that they're supposedly addressing are, I think, in some ways.
Do you think there's maybe an element of sometimes our fears get the better of us and history is more complex than we might initially suppose?
I would like to think that was written in that way, that would be a refreshing difference.
Or maybe they just don't want our entertainment to be too disturbing.
Right, right. Is an element of that maybe even a little subversiveness in that. So the Dr. Dex Sutcliffe ends up Sutcliffe giving his the villain's standard explanation of what's going on, the villain's confession, which is a trope we see often in movies and TV, and explains that the creature, he didn't capture the creature himself. The creature has been in under the ice for centuries. Controlled by his family. No explanation of how they captured such a thing. Maybe it grew to the length it did at some point, but
I really like the fact that, you know, even though they established that Lord Sutcliffe is a human, they never explain is the creature extraterrestrial or not. They leave that deliberately ambiguous, and I really like that, to think that maybe this thing is native to Earth, but maybe it's not. I like that ambiguity.
I mean, the doctor even refers to it at one point as a Loch Ness monster, which, you know, as opposed to the Loch Ness monster. It's sort of it is an open question.
Well, that one is alien. We know that from previous Doctor Who.
Well, that's true. There's sort of when I first saw this was the thing that kind of got me. I kind of felt like a little disappointed. It felt like a retread of The Beast Below in some sense. Here you have a creature that's been harnessed for industrial production. At first, we think it's the bad guy in evil, but the real evil turns out to be the rich people using it for their own purposes.
And it's under London. Earth London instead of space London.
Exactly. So that was the source of. I felt like it was a retread and not all that original. I like the use of the time period in Regency England and some of that stuff, but just this is a symptom of, I think, not just of Doctor Who, but a lot of long running TV series, especially sci-fi series, is the tendency to revisit premises that they've used before.
And they have to do that to some degree. I mean, there's only a finite number of plots that's something writers often talk about. I mean, we're watching the same basic plot over and over again in many different things. It's just a question of how do you do it on this occasion. And on this occasion, I think that in some ways, compared to The Beast Below, I think The Beast Below was a more gripping episode. Not only did it have a lot of creepier stuff in it, this has a more kind of fun fantasy feel to it, with the Frost Fair and everything. But in The Beast Below, there was lots of creepy stuff, like the sinister, grinning heads that would turn and watch people. And then there's the horrifying choice when people discover the truth. They're given this choice to forget it or not. And most of the people choose to forget. And that, choice makes you just – it really ramps up the drama of what is the secret that they're – it's so bad they're willing to forget it. And so I thought there was a lot of really effective stuff in The Beast Below that this one didn't capture in the same way.
It is interesting that The Beast Below performed at its time, when it aired, or in its point in the sequence of this Doctor story, the same role that this does, which is Amy being introduced to the complexities of the Doctor's adventures, and Bill being exposed to that, and both of them having to make certain hard choices like the Doctor has to make, sort of being educated on this is what it takes, these are the sorts of things that happen when I travel. It's not all good times and tourist traps. It is dangerous and complex and morally fraught.
It's even at the same point in the series.
Yes.
So you had this is episode 3 of this season. The Beast Below was episode 2 of season 5 when Matt Smith had just come in and just picked up Amy.
Exactly. So the very similar circumstances. And then we come to, Sutcliffe is very cavalier about the lives. He's basically feeding the people of London to this creature, and is very cavalier about it. He says, if we would have just used coal instead, people die in the coal mines every day. Never mind the fact that coal miners choose to have they understand the danger they're undertaking to go in. But he sort of ignores that. But the Doctor has his great speech here. Another great speech by the Doctor. I'll kind of read it. It's very quick. Human progress isn't measured by industry. It's measured by the value you place on a life. An unimportant life, a life without privilege. The boy who died on the river, that boy's value is your value. That's what defines an age. That's what defines a species. Hmm. And I want to cheer. Yes!
Yeah.
This is what's been lost in our society.
I love Bill's response when they're in the carriage. How are you really 2,000 years old? Doctor kind of, yeah, why? Because I want to know how old you have to be to have a speech like that.
Well, I have to say, it reminds me of St. John Paul, his speech about in Evangelium Vitae, not a speech, but what he says about something similar, which is society will be judged on the basis of how it treats its weakest members. Mm-hmm. And in that, he was talking mostly especially about the unborn and the dying in reference to abortion and assisted suicide. I don't want to get too much into controversial issues, but I just thought it was a very compelling, the Doctor's sort of championing the value of every human life, which is a huge contrast to the moment in which we felt he was cold and callous toward the death of Spider. So there's almost a journey of the Doctor here. Or he's revealing that he really was disturbed by that, the death of that child.
There's an interesting, we're meant to cheer at this speech. And in order to generate that reaction, the speech has to go on for just a little bit. It's not very long. But, this is one of many instances in the history of Doctor Who where the Doctor talks about the value of the individual life and especially the downtrodden. And I think my favorite is a line that actually occurs in the Matt Smith Christmas episode, A Christmas Carol, because he's in the I won't say the name of the character because I'll mess it up, but he's in the rich man's house and he's got the woman in an ice chest. who's in suspended animation. And the rich man is saying, the doctor is saying, well, who is this? And the rich man says, oh, it's nobody important. And the doctor just turns on him and says, that's interesting. I've never met anyone who wasn't important. And that's just crushing. And yeah. I just love that expression of the sentiment.
Yes. There have been a lot of moments like that. The doctor is essentially he's a champion of the little guy. He's seen all the great things of time and space, but it's the individual, the small person, who often captures his attention the most. That's one of the reasons I love Doctor Who, is because it's not about the grand things. It's often about the little things, the things that that we would sometimes consider unimportant. So I like that. Sutcliffe's plan, his dastardly plan now, is because we now has to come to a conclusion, is he needs to feed the beast a whole bunch at once by blowing up the ice and dropping everyone in the river for it to munch up.
And I'm not really clear what his plan after that is. I mean, he's kind of destroying the family business here.
Well, the creature has been there for hundreds of years, even when there's not frost. And there must be like these times of so-called feast and famine for the creature, where it freezes the ice and feeds on the people on the ice, and then there are time periods when the ice is frost free, and it just feeds on the occasional person who falls in or something. I don't know, into the Thames.
You'd think it'd have to move too, because it basically fills up a huge chunk of the Thames. So maybe they swim it out to sea or something for years, and then bring it back.
Maybe, that's a bit of. We could do a lot of retconning and headcanon on it, but it's there's a giant hang a lantern.
Impossibility.
Hang a lantern and go on that.
This definitely sounds like a Snidely Whiplash scheme, though, doesn't it?
I was going to say he's in full melodrama villain mode at this point.
You see him with the mustache,
right down to the dynamite, the plunger to blow up the dynamite, or which is not dynamite, but it's all right there, the whole shebang. We have yes.
Before we get to the plunger, there's the moment where Bill and the doctor are tied up in that hut,
right,
and they're about to be blown up, and the guy with the tattoo comes in and gets the sonic screwdriver, which the doctor has realized he can use to attract the fish that make the hole in the ice. And he lets the guy get the sonic screwdriver so that the fish come and make a hole under him, and as that's happening, he gets the guy to toss the sonic screwdriver back to him, and thus he kills this guy in front of Bill. But she at this point is prepared to see his point that sometimes there are not better options.
Right.
And in order for the two of them to survive and save everybody else, they've got to get out of the situation, and allowing this guy to fall through the ice is key to that happening.
So there is this interesting, another trope of the heroes being tied to the explosives and then left alone, to free themselves. Sutcliffe claims that no one will remember all those who die; that they'll just be footnotes in history. That whatever he does, no one will remember. Which is an irony. We come back to this because Sutcliffe himself will die in this scene and ends up becoming a footnote in history, just like he claimed. The doctor basically he frees himself and Bill. Now we've got to figure out what to do. Do we kill the creature? Or do we free the creature? And if we free the creature, Bill says, you will start eating people half of the South Bank of the Thames, and just like in Kill the Moon. The doctor, where the doctor gave Clara a choice to whether to kill the dragon egg, the moon dragon egg. As we revisit that one, but just like that choice, the doctor gives Bill the choice of what to do about the creature. So it's like he's grooming them. He's training them to be a companion, and once they've finished this training period, they'll be suitable for traveling with him, I guess. And then she chooses to save the creature, which, and I think maybe she passes a test about, you know, does she have that moral backbone that she was so insistent on.
It's interesting to wonder what would have happened if she had chosen differently, because what the doctor tells her is that, you know, your humanity, I'm just here to serve. I'm going to do what you, at the moment, your humanity is only representative. So I'm going to leave this up to you. If you tell me to release the beast, I will. If you tell me not to release the beast, I won't. But would that really have happened? If she had said, no, let's not free the beast, I could see the doctor saying, okay, guess what? You're not worthy to be my companion. I'm taking you home immediately.
I could see that too. I think it was a test. So we have off screen, the doctor improbably moves the explosives under the ice. You know, he gets on the diving
really
suit.
Quickly. Magically, he puts on the whole scuba suit, you know,
which is around somewhere.
Yeah.
Moves all the stuff under the ice and places it precisely next to the chains. And so Sutcliffe inadvertently releases the creature, which breaks up the ice, and he ends up getting sucked underneath and eaten. And then they bring the urchins to Sutcliffe's home, forge his will to put young Perry as the long lost heir, and everything
Alter
gets
his will.
Yep. They leave so that all of his wealth ends up being left to the urchins, which is another nice little twist that we add to the story.
And here's where we hit the sexism.
Yes, because.
His heir can't be a girl, even
right.
though the urchins have a leader who's a girl. She can't be the one to inherit, so they have to pick a boy.
Which, I'm not even sure that that's true for the time period. I mean, I'm going to guess that young women who were like the sole heir of a parent, inherited.
Well, immediately, you also had the skin color issue as well, where it was clear that she would not have been a legitimate offspring of his,
right?
To inherit,
but they don't bring that into it. I mean, they could have, but they don't bring that in.
That's kind of reading into it, admittedly, but that is kind of one of the undertones there.
I think that this may have to do not with the law in general, which of course would have allowed women to inherit in case of a non-male heir, but it may have to do with the intricacies of entailments and who gets to inherit these big estates, because frequently these big estates had special rules that applied to them. And this is, you know, like if you watch Downton Abbey or Upstairs, Downstairs, the intricacies of who gets to inherit what based on the historic way these inheritances were set up. And how prior people's wills and legal agreements were fashioned is one of the things that often drives the plot. And so it could be that there's some must be a male heir thing in the way this estate has been set up, even though that wouldn't apply to just ordinary families.
Interesting. Okay. Okay.
More headcanon.
Yeah. more headcanon. So. We leave the children in 1814. They return finally to the doctor's office at the university, at which point Nardole arrives and he says, "Here's your tea. I put some coffee in it to give it some flavor," which I love. As a coffee snob, I agree.
As a tea drinker, it can be kind of flavorless.
And then he notices that they're wearing costumes from a different time period, and he begins to badger the doctor about it, at which point the doctor challenges him to a coin flip contest, which it seems that the doctor has learned the fish pie salesman's trick that he was trying to get from him in order to get Nardole to leave him alone about traveling and not staying near the vault. But Bill's concerned about. She wants to find out what they changed by their time traveling. She's gone back to that question, and confused why it didn't cause anything to show up in the history books or Google. Now I'm certain if I Googled 1814 Frost Fair sea creature, something would come up before this episode aired. Of course,
I was gonna say
something could come up now. But, you know, that's okay. It's I'll give him a pass on that. But the Doctor says, don't underestimate the human ability to overlook the inexplicable. And also, the Frost Fair involved a lot of day drinking. So, so he kind of waves his hand at that. And we have this resolution, which is all fine. I don't think nothing too dramatic in these scenes. But what happens next is really the big one.
There's a neat little nod in that scene where Bill is using her smartphone to look up the sea creature. The search engine she's using is searchwise.net, search-wise.net, which is the same search engine that Rose Tyler used to look up the Doctor back when she first encountered him in the relaunch episode of the new series.
Oh, that's a nice connection. That's a nice connection. What comes next, though, is Nardole is down in the vault that we saw in the first episode, and something knocks from the inside.
And he says, knocking, what's that all about?
Yes, and but he also he also addresses the whoever's on the other side, what has he told you? And, you know, and he basically tells, you know, even though he may be traveling, you know, I'm here, I'm watching you.
He says maybe he's got a little friend now and he's a little distracted, but I'm still going to be watching. And this is kind of interesting because Nardole has just wondered what has the Doctor been telling whoever's on the other side of the wall. And now he's just blurted this out. You know, it's like if the Doctor hadn't told whoever it is that, well, you just did.
Right. So your theories, you have any theories who's on the other side of that door?
I do, but I'll let others go first.
Oh, Father Corey, you go first, and I'll go, and then we'll let Jimmy have the last word on that.
I mean, probably the I don't know. I guess my first and probably the most obvious one is Missy.
Okay. All right.
I mean, that was kind of my first initial thought, especially with the rumor of the Two Masters episode coming up.
Mm-hmm. And there's, I've seen other people say, the John Sims Master. Harold Saxon behind there. But my theory, now this is a kind of off the wall, and it's based on some of the rumors about how the regeneration takes place. I think the Doctor's on the other side of that door. A different incarnation.
Number one is supposed to return under the actor who played in Adventures, Space and Time.
Yes, or number 13.
Or number 12 in mid-regeneration.
Yes, yes, something like that. Like the regeneration had started, and maybe it got they're trying to keep it from continuing, or something to that effect, or some other very complex Doctor Who reason. So that's my theory: is the Doctor is on the other side of that door. What about you, Jimmy?
I think that's a very interesting thought. If it's a future Doctor, there's a little bit of a question about how do we explain Nardole's monologue here, where he's saying, you know, okay, he's got a companion now and he's a little distracted. Well, he would be able to remember that if it was a future version of the Doctor. And I'm not sure why the Time Lords would lock up the original Doctor. It would be a very dramatic reveal if they go that way.
Yeah.
If I had to lay money, though, my bet would be it's some incarnation of the Master, quite possibly the John Sims one. And the reason I say that is because – and it could be another incarnation, including one we've never even seen. It could be a revived Roger Delgado, just like they're going to apparently have a revived William Hartnell. So it could be that. But the reason I mention the Master here in particular is because of the prophecy about how the 10th Doctor would fall. The Ood told the 10th Doctor, David Tennant, that when his song comes to an end, he will knock four times. And there was all this misdirection about who's going to knock four times. And eventually it ends up, or one of the people who knocked four times ends up being Wilfred Mott, who's trapped in the radiation chamber and knocks lightly four times. And that gets David Tennant to go in and expose himself to the radiation to save Wilfred. But before that, the Master is right there fighting the Time Lords, and he's got these energy powers at this point, and he counts out four massive knocks as he's battling the Time Lords. And this is the John Sims Master. And then he disappears. He goes into the time warp with Gallifrey after delivering these four massive knocks.
Mm-hmm.
And in this little end scene with Nardole, we hear these three knocks. And Nardole says, "Knocking, what's that all about?" And I think that's a deliberate callback to the prophecy. And whoever's on the other side is obviously important to the Doctor. It's someone the Doctor would talk to and tell stuff to, which fits the Master. And we keep having this series of three knocks until the very end, and the very closing set of knocks is indeed four knocks. I went back and listened to it and counted before we did the show. And so, and they're big, booming, massive knocks too. They're not just little ones like Wilfred did. So I think the preponderance of evidence seems to fit the Master, possibly the John Sims Master, since this is a Time Lord artifact. And the last we saw of him was plunging into the warp with the Time Lords. That would be what I'd lay money on if I had to.
Interestingly, you bring it up, the prophecy of the Ood, four knocks and the Doctor will fall, given that the title of the last episode of the season before the Christmas special is The Doctor Falls.
Yeah.
Mm. So that's a very good, you're probably more right than I'm going out on a limb, but I'm guessing, given everything we know, that might be it. Not exactly a spoiler, because it's not, we're not going based on rumors and things. Yes, it's just speculation. Yeah. Maybe listeners can give us their theories or tell us what they think of our theories or whether I'm all wet or not.
And by the way, I do want to mention, if it is like a future Doctor, they always do that, to use the term Jimmy brought up, hang a lantern on. Oh, if they're out of their timeline, they don't remember what happened when they're put back in their timeline.
Yes.
So it could be a Doctor out of his timeline not remembering the fact that this happened.
Like the Day of the Doctors.
The five Doctors, the two Doctors, things like that.
Yeah.
They always say, well, why does the Doctor not remember this happened? Oh, he was out of his timeline. His past selves were out of his timeline, so he doesn't remember that it happened.
And
they've done that sometimes. I don't know that they do that all the time. But yes, you're right. They could use that.
Yeah, and then we still have that interesting moment from the name of the Doctor. I think it was the name of the Doctor. I keep mixing up the specials, but where all 12 Doctors showed up to save Gallifrey, and we saw the 12th Doctor's, just his eyes and throwing the lever. So, which we have not seen yet, him do that yet in the series. So anyway,
Stephen Moffat's a completist, so he's likely, he admits he worries about how do these things all fit into continuity, and he fills in the holes. So we could well get an explanation for that on screen.
All right. So given all that, I think it was a good discussion. Like I said, my overall take on the show was it improved on my second viewing. When I was kind of going through some of the details, I liked it. Jimmy, you liked it.
I liked it, but I also have a concern about it, not so much about this episode individually, but the trajectory of the series, because this episode, it dealt with a bunch of different social issues, and it did it largely without being preachy about them, and I liked that. But when you set it in context of the first episode, we've got the fact that Bill is gay. The second episode, we have a slave rebellion plot. With the humans as the bad guys. The third episode, we've got this whole spate of social issues. And I think it's good for fiction to engage social issues, and science fiction has a particular knack for doing that. But usually it's not so straightforward, and it can come off as preaching if you get too straightforward about it. Mark Twain famously had a saying that, fiction should never preach explicitly, but should always preach implicitly. Mm-hmm. And that's what Doctor Who has been good at. And I'd hate to see it get kind of crass and relentless in its handling of social issues.
Okay. That's a good take. Father Corey, you have any final thoughts on this episode?
I guess kind of, I hate to sound repetitive, but it's kind of same with Jimmy, that they are enjoying the preaching a little too much. I did enjoy the episode. I thought it was a fun episode.
Yeah.
And it was kind of interesting that it was more of a light episode, even with as dark a theme as it potentially could have been. There were, you know, like many of these episodes, there were weaknesses that were pretty glaring as we were talking about them. But no, it was, I thought it was a good episode. I just hope they, like, you know, because I mentioned my concern when they first introduced Bill that she was going, that was going to be her main theme, was that she was homosexual. And no, they're just going to have all kinds of things they're going to preach about, it sounds like, at least so far.
Right, right. Okay. Well, I mean, that's a good take. So, you know, let us know what you thought of it. You know, what did you think of this episode? What did you think of our take on it? We've gotten a little some feedback from folks. We'd love to get more on our previous episodes. Let us know. Visit tradio.com and find the show page and leave us a comment there. Visit us at the Secrets of Doctor Who Facebook page or the tradio.com Facebook page. Leave us some feedback. Let us know what you thought. We'd love to kind of discuss your feedback on the show. And if you can, go to iTunes, leave a review of Secrets of Doctor Who. That reviews help us to reach more people because it tells the iTunes to show the podcast to people that people are listening and like it. So we'll be back next week. We'll be discussing the next episode entitled Knock Knock. No knock knock jokes yet. We'll have some next week. So until then, Jimmy, where can people find you online?
They can find me at jimmyaiken.com and also at letswatchdoctorwho.com. blogspot.com.
Great. And Father Corey, where can people find you?
My website's frcorey.org. Twitter, Facebook, things like that. Fr Corey Sticha, last name spelled Sticha.
And you can all find me at betnet.com. You can find all my social media links and all that. So until next week, thank you for listening and keep watching Doctor Who.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.